You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 21st of October 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. And I am very, very pleased to say that I have my co-host with me today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today? It's a beautiful, glorious, sunny day here in Wales. How is it with you over in the east of the country?
Well, it's not as glorious and sunny. It's a bright day, but it's pretty overcast. But you know, I always say that we should enjoy the weather, whatever it is. And yes, I'm still enjoying the weather, even though it's not sunny.
there may be sunshine over the horizon. Is there going to be sunshine over the horizon for Boris Johnson and his Brexit deal? We don't know yet today. We're recording this at lunchtime, and that's before anything's really got going in the Houses of Parliament. But I'm sure listeners are all aware of what went on Saturday. Absolutely disgraceful behaviour by the Remainers. I'm sure people will remember that there was this surrender act that was created by Hillary Benn, which basically should never have been created. It was tabled by a member of the opposition, something which they're not supposed to be able to do because they're in the opposition. But the Speaker of the House allowed it to happen. And this bill basically said that if Boris Johnson did not get a deal before October the 19th, he was going to have to beg the EU for an extension. Boris Johnson then confounded all expectations, did actually manage to get a bill, which he was going to put before the House on that Saturday. And the Remainers moved the goalposts. They moved the goalposts and they tabled another act, another amendment. And this time it was Oliver Letwin, a notional Tory who was also responsible for the poll tax and also responsible for this hideous fixed term parliament act, which is actually preventing us from having a general election at the moment. This notional Tory who was sat there with the Independence Party and all the other lefty Remainers tabled this bill to say that despite the fact that Boris Johnson has managed to get a deal, he still has to go and beg for an extension. I mean, what an insult to the Prime Minister to allow the government to have a vote on that. It's just unbelievable that they allowed them all to have a vote. The Speaker allowed them to vote on this. And it went through, of course, because Parliament is filled with traitors. And because of that, Boris Johnson then had to pull his bill. Because what is the point of putting the deal before them if they're going to force him to seek an extension anyway? And then he did send the letter. But he did what I think you said he was going to do last week, Max. Wasn't that right? You said he would send the letter but not sign it, or sign the letter but not send it. Which of the two was it that you mentioned the other week?
Well, I thought that he might sign the letter but not send it. You see, if he had produced a letter, signed it in front of, he could have signed it in front of the press, could have held a press conference and signed the letter then very grandly, put it into an envelope and licked the envelope and sealed it and handed it over to a courier. But he could then have perhaps, or somebody within the Conservative Party could have organised some kind of a sit-in demonstration in which, you know, perhaps 1,000 Conservative supporters could have invaded Boris Johnson's office and prevented anybody from moving. And then they could have just sat there for 2 weeks until the 31st of October had passed, in which case Boris Johnson would have fulfilled his requirement of actually producing the letter and signing it and actually dispatching it for transfer over to the European Union. But the postman or the that the courier would have been physically prevented from actually doing that by the crowds of people in the building. That was one thing that sort of occurred to me that might happen. The other thing as well is that there is a convention called the Vienna Convention, which is a convention about international treaties and the way in which international treaties should be interpreted and etc. And I think it's Article 51 of the Vienna Convention basically says, I haven't got it in front of me now, but it's words to the effect that any treaty that is effected by a national representative, where that national representative has been forced by threats against his person or threats of punishment, is void. And so, as far as Boris Johnson is concerned, he would have been signing a letter against his will on the basis of the threat of punishment of being prosecuted and sent to prison. And so, therefore, under the Vienna Convention, my interpretation is that he could quite rightly have claimed that the that his signature on that letter had been procured under duress and would therefore be invalid under the Vienna Convention. However, what he chose to do was to send the letter without signing it, because strictly speaking, according to the letter of the law, he was required to send the letter, but not necessarily to sign it. There was no mention of him having to sign the letter. So he sent the letter unsigned, sent it together with a letter from one of the diplomats to the European Union, who then attached another letter saying that that this letter was sent in accordance with the Ben Surrender Act, but that it didn't necessarily represent the wishes of the British government. And then another letter was attached to it, again, this time from Boris Johnson, that Boris Johnson had signed, basically saying that he wanted them just to get on with implementing the agreement that they had reached. And so therefore, without him sort of specifically saying so, effectively urging them to ignore the extension letter and just get on with implementing the agreement with effect from the 31st of October, as they had agreed. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. I think there is still the possibility of Boris being prosecuted for contempt of court. I don't know that that would necessarily succeed. In fact, I doubt that it would, but it's a possibility that's being muted in certain quarters. But I think as far as the European Union are concerned, they have now indicated that they are prepared to entertain another extension to Brexit, because it appears that there is a conspiracy amongst the Remainers within Parliament to prevent Boris Johnson's agreement from being passed in Parliament. And so therefore, there will then be an extension beyond the 31st of October. And I would imagine that extension probably will be to the 1st of January, which was the date that I think had been agreed between the Remainers and some representatives of the European Union as being a date that they thought would be suitable. And the drama drags on.
I did think that Macron and Merkel had said that they weren't going to allow an extension. And they did say, we're not going to allow an extension, because they want this deal to go through. And if they say, we're not allowing an extension, then that means it's either Boris's deal or it's no deal by the 31st of October, which will encourage the Remainers to vote for Boris's bill and get that bill through. So, I mean, I don't know that they will allow an extension. Another problem that that could raise its head is the Remainers are talking about adding lots of amendments to it. And if the Speaker of the House allows the opposition to add amendments to it, which he has done before, Labour are saying they're going to add an amendment to it, that there has to be another referendum on Boris's deal before it goes through. So, you know, the EU may say we're not going to allow another extension because they know that if they do allow it, then all these amendments are going to get tabled to it as well. It's an awful mess. And also they're saying that the Speaker of the House may not even allow Boris Johnson to put his deal to the vote today. That Speaker of the House, the minute he leaves on the 31st of October, I want to see him clapped in irons and held to account for what he's done, trampling over the Constitution, total overreach of his authority. The man is supposed to just be a rhetorical device. Whenever the politicians are talking in the Houses of Parliament, they address what they are saying to the Speaker, rather than addressing what they're saying to one another or to the public or whatever. It's just a rhetorical device. And because of that, because everybody seems to be addressing the Speaker of the House, all that has gone to his head. And he now thinks that he's the man in charge and he's above the Prime Minister, and he's not. And what he's engaged in is treason. He's colluding with a foreign power. He's colluding to frustrate the democratic will of the British public. He's even got the Queen into trouble. And I know that the Conservatives at the moment, they're investigating Dominic Grieve and a few others for colluding with a foreign power, for working with the EU lawyers in order to draft that Ben Act. So it wouldn't surprise me if they do go after the Speaker once his parliamentary privilege is over. And I would so love to see that, wouldn't you, Max? See that horrible little man in the dock? I would so love to see that.
He's not the only person that I would like to see in the dock, but I think that what you say is correct, that you see, it's really a matter of the political will of the government. And we're in a situation where what's being decided is whether Britain should be an independent nation, or whether an independent and sovereign nation, or whether Britain should be a vassal state of a foreign power. And in any other time in history, anybody that actually worked to subordinate the British Parliament to a foreign power would have been accused of treason. And under the old Treason Acts, it would have been regarded as treason. But obviously, I think, as most people know now, the Treason Act was effectively removed by, I think it was one of the Labour governments in the early part of this century.
Tony Blair, it was.
And Tony Blair, yeah. And so the old definitions of treason no longer apply. Unless, of course, the justices who formed the Supreme Court in this country were of a mind to interpret the existing law as closely to that old law as possible. But it's fairly evident from the cases that have gone before the Supreme Court already that the justices of the Supreme Court would. It's highly unlikely that they would interpret the laws of treason in the way that the man in the street would interpret the laws of treason. And so it's unlikely that I think that a prosecution for treason would actually succeed. What's needed really is a general election. The parliament is at the moment in a state of chaos because the prime minister doesn't have a majority, and because the MPs are broken up into so many different factions, all with different ideas, and because the Speaker is totally at odds and at variance with the government, and interpreting parliamentary convention in ways in which it's never been interpreted before, and with the aim in mind of frustrating the business of the government. So what we need is a general election so that the government then has a majority and they can then take control again and begin to rule the country. And that really is the most important thing. I think at the moment we're in a situation where, as far as the European Union are concerned, they would be quite happy for Boris Johnson's agreement with them to be passed. But it, because it looks so unlikely that Boris Johnson's agreement will not be passed, if the European Union refuse to provide an extension to Article 50, then we're going to leave the European Union on a no-deal basis, and that they don't want either. So the European Union will offer an extension unless Boris Johnson, by some miracle, manages to persuade the Speaker to allow him to represent his agreement to Parliament, and Parliament passes it. So I think we're in for a very torturous week of wrangling that's going to be taking place. Either way, we're going to be in a situation where either Boris Johnson gets his his agreement through Parliament, in which case we'll leave on the terms that he's agreed, or there will be an extension. And that may well then lead to a general election, although, you know, there has been some talk of the opposition parties dragging it out so that there isn't even a general election before January. We can't really be sure really quite what way it's going to turn out. But I would like to think that even the most brazenly anti-Brexit MPs in Parliament, even they would grant a general election if this week Boris Johnson fails to get his deal through Parliament, in which case because if they don't, then that what they're really doing is they're demonstrating that they have got complete and utter contempt for the electorate. They don't want the electorate to be able to decide what happens with regard to Brexit. And again, that then creates another constitutional crisis.
Well, if you look at the polls, the Conservative Party have a massive lead. I think they've got twice as much as Labour. So this is why the opposition don't want to have a general election. And to be honest, why would they want a general election if the Speaker of the House is going to allow them to take control of Parliament's timetable? Because that's basically what it is. The party that is in power, they have control over the timetable. They say what is going to be debated. They put the bills to the House for everybody to vote upon. That's the way it's supposed to be done. The Speaker of the House has turned that upside down and is now allowing the opposition to set the timetable of what's going to be debated and what bills are going to be put before the House. So effectively, the opposition are in power. That's what I mean. There's been this massive power grab by the Speaker of the House in order to put the opposition in the position that the elected party in power should be in. It's an absolutely shocking state of affairs. And, you know, when you look at the outside of the Houses of Parliament, it's just covered in European Union flags, and just a naked treason is going on in the Houses of Parliament. Outside there were thousands of people on Saturday. Jacob Rees-Mogg had to have an entire squad of police there to protect him on his way back. People shouting Nazi at him and white supremacist. And his child was there as well. His son was there. I mean, he likes to bring his son there on a Saturday. Quite a few of the MPs do like to do that. And he had to have a police escort because the threat of violence was so much from these rabid lefties that are just determined to frustrate the will of the British public, which is to leave the European Union. I found it quite interesting, the arguments that Keir Starmer was putting across as to why we shouldn't have Boris Johnson's deal. And one thing that he kept pointing out was EU workers' rights. And we were not going to be aligned with EU workers' rights. And a lot of people have been pointing out that in actual fact, Britain has far better workers' rights than the EU. In Britain, you get sick pay for 28 weeks of the year. In the European Union, there's no sick pay that's set. In the UK, you get paid holiday for 5.6 weeks of the year. European Union workers' rights say that you should only get paid holiday for 4 weeks of the year. UK maternity pay, 52 weeks. European Union maternity pay, 14 weeks. UK minimum wage, £8.21. European Union minimum wage, none set at all. So Britain's workers' rights are far better than the European Union's workers' rights. And this is the reason why so many people from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe come to Britain looking for work, because the workers' rights are so much better, because the wages are so much better. And yet this is the argument that Keir Starmer is putting across. They're deliberately just prevaricating and trying to put a delay in there. The wording that they're using, I found that interesting as well. They keep talking about a meaningful vote as if all the other votes they have are meaningless. You've got the people's referendum as if the people that voted in the last referendum were all subhuman. And this is all of this is before we even get into the substance of Boris Johnson's deal, which, according to Nigel Farage, is an absolute travesty. It's just another treaty. It means that the Northern Ireland is actually hived off from the UK. It means that there's going to be years of wrangling that goes on after this. So it's really not that good a deal. But if you listen to what the opposition are saying, it sounds really good for us because they absolutely hate it. They're saying that it's as bad as a no-deal Brexit. It's 10 times worse than Theresa May's deal. And all of that makes me think, well, Boris's deal's got to be pretty good if they really hate it. But the one fly in the ointment there, as I say, is Nigel Farage, who says that it's not such a good deal. The European Research Group, they're all behind it. They have said we are recommending everybody vote for this deal. But if the opposition are allowed to start tabling amendments to it, then we're not going to vote for it. So, as you say, it's all still up in the air again, Max. The only way out of this really is to just leave on the 31st with no deal, because I don't think they're going to be able to come to an agreement, to be honest.
Yes, I think that leaving with no deal would be the best option. I think as far as the agreement that Boris Johnson has made, it is a version of the deal that was originally negotiated by Theresa May, but has got less in which Britain would follow less closely the legislation that exists in the European Union. But it is an agreement which also will eventually lead to the surrender of Northern Ireland to the European Union. And it was interesting that quite some time ago, I think it was in November 2018, Dominic Raab, who was the secretary for negotiation of Brexit under Theresa May, he reported that through diplomatic channels he had heard the assertion, and this had reputedly come from Martin Selmayr, who was one of the big wigs in the European Commission, that the price that Britain would pay for Brexit would be that we would have to surrender Northern Ireland to the European Union. And this was denied by Martin Selmayr at the time. But then we had this famous conversation on the telephone between Boris Johnson and Angela Merkel about sort of 10 days or so ago, in which Angela Merkel again asserted that the price that Britain would pay for leaving the European Union would be the loss of Northern Ireland, but that Northern Ireland would have to remain under the jurisdiction of the European Union forever. And although Angela Merkel has refused to comment on the content of the conversation she had with Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson's office, the 10 Downing Street, have stated that was the content of that conversation. And now we're in a situation where Boris Johnson has agreed to an arrangement in which there is a deviation from the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. The terms of the Good Friday Agreement is that there would not be any constitutional changes in Northern Ireland without the agreement of a majority of both of the traditions in Ireland, both the Unionist tradition and the Republican tradition. But now we're in a situation where he has agreed with the European Union that unless a majority, just a simple majority of the Irish people vote for vote to leave the jurisdiction of the European Union in roughly 5 years' time, then there will be an extension of the period of European Union dominion over Northern Ireland, and that this dominion will then just carry on being extended and extended, so that effectively Northern Ireland will become progressively detached from the United Kingdom and will spend more and more time under the jurisdiction of the European Union. Eventually, what will happen is that there will be a contrived referendum in Northern Ireland, at which then there will be a majority of people who will want to join the South. And so the South will effectively be lost. So Boris Johnson's deal has in effect created the conditions whereby there will be an eventual United Ireland under the auspices of the European Union, and the British and the United Kingdom will surrender the six counties of Ulster to Eire. It's ironic, really, that at the end of the Irish War of Independence that ended in, I think it was 1921, and under the terms of the agreement that was then negotiated between Lloyd George, who was the Prime Minister, and Michael Collins and others who were representing the new Irish Free State, the price that the Irish Free State had to pay in order to have independence from the United Kingdom was that the Irish Free State had to surrender those six counties of Ulster. And now we're in a situation where, in order to secure our freedom from the European Union, the United Kingdom government is having to surrender those same six counties of Ulster back to a United Ireland under the auspices of the European Union. So it's sort of a little bit of bitterness, sort of a bitter irony there for people who are like ourselves, proponents of a united Britain. And that's an aspect of this deal that Boris Johnson has negotiated that hasn't actually been talked about that much in the press.
Yeah, the DUP have said that they're not happy with it. They're not voting for it. And I wondered, you know, quite why that was, because it seemed to me as if, well, in 4 years' time, they'll get a vote on, you know, whether. So it's down to them to decide quite what they want to do. But apparently the board is going to be in the Irish Channel there in between Northern Ireland and the mainland, which obviously means that it's been hived off to Southern Ireland, basically. So you can understand why they are upset. I think they're having abortion forced upon them as well, something which they said that they never wanted in Northern Ireland. I think that's now being forced upon them today. And I do believe it's the anniversary of Trafalgar today, Max. Is that correct?
It is, yes. It's the anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar, which took place on the 21st of October 1805. And I thought that it was a significant date today because of the fact that we've been talking about Great Britons in our previous broadcasts. And, of course, the Great Britain who performed and won the day during the Battle of Trafalgar was Lord Nelson. And I thought it would be a fitting tribute to him for us to discuss the Battle of Trafalgar today on the programme. And I mean, Nelson had distinguished himself as a sailor long before the Battle of Trafalgar, and he had suffered various injuries and things, the loss of an eye and one of his arms. And but he was established as an admiral of the fleet around about towards the end of the 18th century, and this was, of course, the period of the Napoleonic Wars. And what had happened is that during the Napoleonic Wars, Nelson had distinguished himself at the Battle of the Nile, where he faced an arch rival who was an Admiral Villeneuve in the French Navy. What had happened is that in the intervening years beyond that, that Napoleon had started to establish himself as the dominant force on the European mainland. And Britain was part of the alliance that was opposing the expansion of French power, Napoleon had decided that he was going to invade Britain, and he had massed an army just near the Straits of Dover, near Boulogne, and he was intent then on creating a flotilla of ships that could carry that army across to the south coast of England. And he had plans to drive the English warships that were currently guarding the English Channel out of the channels in order to facilitate that invasion. And so he had instructed Admiral Villeneuve to bring the French fleet together. Admiral Villeneuve at the time had been blockaded into the harbour of Toulon, which is in the Mediterranean, and there was Nelson was actually leading a fleet of British ships that were blockading that port to prevent Villeneuve from getting out, but also the The French also had another fleet that was located in Brest in Brittany, which again was being blockaded and prevented from coming out. And there were British fleets that were blockading the major ports of Spain, and Spain was an ally of France at the time. So Napoleon's plan was that Villeneuve should break out of the blockade at Toulon, should then sail out through the Straits of Gibraltar, should unite with the Spanish Navy that was currently in Cadiz, and to then sail to the Caribbean, where they were going to pick up other ships and things, and then come back across the Atlantic to relieve the blockade of Brest, to sail into the English Channel, to drive the Royal Naval ships out of the Channel so that the flotilla could then go across and invade England. And what happened, though, was that initially a British fleet was sent down to Cadiz to maintain the blockade there, and Nelson had just returned to Britain from other ventures that he'd been involved in. The Victory had been refitted, and he then sailed down to Cadiz, where he then took control of the fleet that we were slowly amassing just in the Atlantic off the coast of Spain near Cadiz. And Villeneuve had sailed across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, had picked up the ships that he needed there, and with a combined fleet that was composed of both Spanish and French ships, he then sailed back across the Atlantic, but sailed back to Cadiz, rather than going north to Brest, where he had originally been instructed to go. He then received fresh orders from Napoleon that he was to make his way up to, initially to back round to Toulon and to drop off some troops there, but ultimately with the intention of coming back round and going back into the English Channel, as I'd already explained. But Nelson then chose to intervene. And what had happened was that Villeneuve had broken out of the blockade at Cadiz and was sailing north, and had his ships in a fairly sort of irregular crescent-shaped pattern, which basically wasn't, strictly speaking, the way in which they should have sailed. The tactic in those days was for a fleet to sail in line, so that they could then pass the ships of the enemy, who would be sailing in line in the opposite direction, and they would like pass together on parallel routes, but in different directions, firing at each other, firing broadsides as they would go. That was the conventional way in which a sea battle would be fought. But his ships were manned by sailors who weren't as well trained as they should be, and so the formation was a bit ragged. But what Nelson chose to do, rather than stick to the conventional mode of battle, he swung his forces round at 90 degrees and then attacked the French line sort of perpendicular to their line of travel, and in two columns, so that one column broke the French line into two, and another column then broke the French and Spanish line into three. And what happened was that they broke them at roughly the sort of the halfway point initially, so that half of the French fleet was left sailing north, then the second column of British ships broke the part that had been detached into two pieces, and the French and Spanish ships were then encircled. In the battle that then proceeded, this trailing part that had been detached from the vanguard were then surrounded and were effectively either destroyed or captured. And so that was a very successful tactic. But by the time the vanguard of the ships had of the French and Spanish ships had managed to turn and come back again, the battle was pretty much over, and they were then faced with a situation where they were outnumbered by the British ships, and after a short engagement, they then decided to depart, and I think only 11 of the Spanish and French ships actually made it back to Cadiz Harbour, and all the rest were either captured or they were chased across the seas, and lots of them were sunk, a lot of them were scuttled, quite a lot of them were captured, and it was a really glorious victory for the British fleet that was massively outnumbered. But significantly outnumbered by the French and the Spanish forces. So if we have a look at the forces that were available to Villeneuve, he had 33 ships of the line, and a ship of the line was basically a large battleship of the sort that would have rows and rows of cannons along either side of its superstructure, and a ship of the line would, a first-rate ship of the line would have something like 120 guns. A second-rate ship of the line would have around about 100 guns. And there were third-rates that had about 80 and fourth-rates that had around about 70 guns. And so these were ships that had a formidable amount of firepower. And the enemy had something like 30,000 men and in total around about 2,500 guns. And they were opposed by Napoleon with only 27 ships, with only 17,000 men and 2,148 guns. But because of the unusual tactics employed by Nelson, the French and the Spanish were defeated. And it was a victory that prevented Napoleon from invading Britain, because the army that he'd amassed in northern France, he then turned and marched into Germany and had further battles that further secured his dominance of the continent thereafter. But it prevented Napoleon from invading Britain, and Nelson sadly was shot during the Battle of Trafalgar and died of his wounds. But such was the great victory that he had secured that his body was preserved in a barrel of brandy, and he was then taken back to Britain for a hero's funeral. And our country is littered with monuments to Nelson, the most famous of which obviously is Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square. But there are other similar columns. There's another one in Great Yarmouth. There's another monument in Southampton. There are monuments in, Liverpool and other places. I can't remember all of the locations now. But as I say, the country is littered with monuments to Nelson, and he was hailed a national hero. And I think that the achievements of a man like him are in keeping with the achievements that we've spoken about before with the other characters that we've celebrated. And I think that it's fitting that on this day, the 21st of October, that we should encourage our people to remember Nelson and his achievements and celebrate them so that we can face the future with greater fortitude.
So it was unconventional warfare, basically, that saved the day. Did that way of fighting become a staple of naval warfare after that, or was it just of use at that one particular time? Because the enemy's fleet weren't so regimented as they normally would be, with having these ships coming from Cadiz that weren't so well trained. Was it a manoeuvre that then became used by the Navy again, do you know?
I'm not sure whether it was ever used again, but I mean, I would imagine it probably would have done, but it did carry with it considerable risks, because for quite some considerable time before the British ships were able to actually engage the French and the Spanish ships, they had to sail towards the broadsides of the enemy ships. And of course, it would take them quite some time to actually reach, because obviously they were wind-powered ships. It'd take them some time, and the Spanish and French ships were releasing broadsides of cannon fire at the British ships that were approaching. But of course, the British ships were approaching them end-on, and so they presented a smaller target, but they only had a very few guns pointing forward on the ships in those days, and so each broadside was only being responded to by sporadic cannon fire from the British ships, and it could have been a disaster if the broadsides from the Spanish and French ships had been sufficient to sink the leading Royal Naval ships before they'd actually managed to reach the enemy. But as luck would have it, the sea at that particular time was fairly rough, and so that then meant that with the ships, I can't think what the term is for it now, with a yee-yaw to a certain extent as a result of the movement of the waves, it then meant that the accuracy of the French and Spanish gunners was hindered, and so therefore the British ships managed to reach and engage them largely unscathed. I think there was just one of the British battleships that had all of its masts shot off by the point it actually reached the Spanish and the French, but the sailors on board still continued to return fire, etc. And the effect of the two lines of Royal Naval ships piercing the line of the Spanish ships was to then leave the vanguard of the Spanish ships, the ones that were right at the front, to leave them to just sail away where they couldn't actually fire at anybody, and then have to turn round. And because although it was a fairly sort of choppy sea, apparently it wasn't, the wind wasn't particularly strong, or it wasn't in the right direction, so it slowed the ability of the leading ships to turn round to come back to sort of assist the ones that had been cut off. And the ones that were in the middle and the latter part of the French and Spanish line, they had obviously been divided into two smaller groups, and they were then encircled by the British ships that then released lots of broadsides into them and severely damaged them, and to good effect. And as I said, before the vanguard of the French and Spanish ships was able to return, the battle was, you know, all but over at that point. And so the tactic had been very, very successful indeed. And I think I've got a list here of the damage and the losses, and it's recorded that the British losses were 458 men dead and 1,208 wounded, but with no ships lost. Whereas the French and the Spanish losses totaled 4,395 dead, 2,500 wounded, 7,500 captured, and with one ship sunk and 22 other ships captured. And of course, the way the ships were captured in those days was that the two ships would eventually come side to side, firing broadsides of cannon fire at each other, and then grappling hooks would be used to hook onto the enemy ship and pull it so that they were, the ships were, the hulls were, came together, and then marines would invade from the attacking ship onto the defending ship, and there would be hand-to-hand fighting that would eventually, that one side would eventually emerge the winner of, and they would then have successfully captured that ship. And part of the problem that the French and the Spanish had was that during the French Revolution, which was only about 15 years beforehand, a very large number of the most experienced French naval officers had been either executed or sacked from the positions that they previously held. And so the French Navy was commanded by inexperienced officers, and lots of the French naval ratings had very little proper training, particularly in gunnery, and so they were inferior in terms of their ability as warfaring sailors to the British sailors.
That's amazing when you think about it. What went on in this marine warfare. I was thinking you were going to say then that because they'd accepted the defeat, the grappling hooks would go over and then they'd just drag the ship along behind them. I didn't realize the marines were going to jump on board and it would be hand-to-hand fighting right through till the bitter end. And then you think about the skill that's involved with getting these winds right. I in looking into Captain Cook and Captain Bligh, particularly Captain Bligh last week, and finding out about these trade winds. You know, there's winds that they can pretty much guess that there's going to be a certain wind in a certain direction all the time in a certain place in the ocean. And then you have to get yourself to that place in the ocean by navigating by the stars or whatever. Again, a skill which white men have developed over thousands of years. So you get yourself in the right position, and then you know that you've got your wind that's going to be taking you. But then you've got to do it at a certain angle, and you've got to be pointing away from the area that you actually want to get to, because you've also got the current that's underneath you. A fantastic amount of skill is involved in doing all of this. And then you think, and on the top of that, you've got to get alongside another vessel, and you're going to be firing at them with cannon. And you think all these instruments that we've got today, like GPS and satellite tracking and all of that, in order to work out exactly where we are, and we've got our tide sheets and tide tables and all the rest of it. And you think you've got people back then, you know, they didn't have GPS. You know, they were lucky if they had a timepiece and they had a compass. And you think of Captain Bligh, and he didn't, I don't think he even had any charts. He just had to go by memory. And you think you can go back even further to the time of the Phoenicians, and the Egyptians and the Phoenicians were able to get all the way to Britain to pick the tin up, to take that back to Phoenicia. There was an Egyptian type ship, I think, that was found off Yorkshire that was 2,000 years old. And they had this skill of navigating and using these ships. And it's always been a white man's skill, and particularly a British skill. Britain was the ruler of the waves, and it features so much in our patriotic songs. And, you know, and that just proves that we used to be the guys that really were on top to beat an army like that. Another thing that it makes me think of there, Max, is how the strategy that's involved in, you've got your enemy ships and they're in one place in a harbour, and then you've got your ships on the outside of it to prevent them from actually being able to get out. And in order to do that, you've got to match the same number of ships, basically. So, and it's almost like today when you've got, you know, one side's got a certain amount of nuclear weapons, another side's got a certain amount of nuclear weapons, and that ensures that there's peace. And back then, you've got one side's got a certain amount of ships, the other side's got a certain amount of ships, and they're both sort of facing one another, and that should hold the peace, basically. And it's these same principles that are used today in warfare, I guess.
Yeah, and after the Battle of Trafalgar, there was an arms race between Napoleon and the British government, where Napoleon vowed, following the Battle of Trafalgar, that he would build a fleet of 150 ships of the line, and so they are these particular kind of battleships. And we responded by building as many ships as we could. I think Napoleon managed to get up to something like about 84 ships of the line, and at the peak, the British Navy was at something like 99 or something like that. And so, you know, we just had to keep constructing more and more ships in order that we could outnumber the French in order to maintain our dominance. And of course, the other aspect was that because we traded with colonies that were across the other side of the world, we had a very large proportion, very large pool of men who were trained as sailors and who could obviously therefore man warships and things, and so and use the skills that they picked up in trade and also in exploration in order to help the Navy win battles that in numerical terms they probably shouldn't have been able to win. And I think that the fact that Nelson used these unconventional tactics in order to win the Battle of Trafalgar is very significant, and it's one of the features of our nation over the centuries is that we've been very inventive in finding new ways in thinking outside the box that's given us the advantage over our opponents or rivals, whether it be in trade or whether it be in war or whatever, and it's no No surprise then that the agricultural revolution began here in Britain, that the industrial revolution began here in Britain, and that lots of things that have been invented, and I think per capita, it's fairly well acknowledged that our nation has invented more things than virtually any other nation.
It's innovation that sets us apart. In actual fact, it's innovation that sets white people apart. When you look at the Chinese, you think some of these Chinese, they've got a higher average IQ than the white man has, but they don't actually invent things. What they do is they miniaturize things that the white man has already invented. It's white people that have this spirit of innovation and discovery that these other races don't have. As you say, Max, the British seem to have a higher proportion of it than others. If you look back at the inventions and the innovation that we had, and you think this tiny little island, it was known to rule the waves. British sea power was the sea power. And you think you can trace that back to King Alfred, and he was the one that supposedly first built up the British Navy and designed the British boats in order to fight against the Vikings. But as I say, before then you had this tradition of the Phoenicians coming to Britain as well, and it all came together in this massive boat building industry that we used to have that they've now done away with. And Britain used to lead the world in boat building, and it used to have this industry all around the coast, and now all we've got left is this one little bit up there at the top of Scotland. I mean, we're an island nation. Boat building, we should be right at the top of boat building, and it's just not an industry that receives very much help from the government anymore. We don't make use of our natural resources. It should be so simple to prevent people from breaking into Britain, because we're surrounded by this huge moat. I mean, they used to put moats around castles because it would keep the castle safe. And we've got a huge moat around the island, and yet we've still got hundreds of Iraqis and Syrians and who knows what else that are managing to arrive upon the shores. And it should just be a simple matter to prevent them from doing that. I think people like Nelson he'd be turning in his grave to see what is happening to his country today. The man was obviously a great patriot, serving country and serving king and doing these unconventional methods. Just going back to these formations as well, these formations of the ships, I mean, it was the battle formation that allowed the Romans to conquer the rest of the world. It was the way that they had that formation I forget the actual name of it now, where they had the shields over the top of their heads and they were in a square rectangle shape.
The phalanx.
Phalanx, that's it. Yeah, the phalanx. And it was the phalanx that enabled them to conquer the world. And then you think how, as the shipbuilding came along, they must have worked out, you know, the best way to have these battles was to have the ships, as you were saying, all in a long line, trailing one past the other, firing away with the cannons. And that's now been improved upon, as well. And of course there were susceptibilities to that, as Nelson saw, when you've got people that aren't that experienced. And again, that shows you that it's experience that matters. You can't just put any old person there into a job and expect them to be able to do it. Again, something which they're doing today, just saying that, well, you need to have somebody in there just because she's a woman. We need to have somebody doing that just because they're black. And you don't. You need people with experience. You need people that are in that position due to merit and merit alone. And, you know, I would say that it was not sticking to that which really, you know, caused Napoleon to lose that battle if he had any experienced sailors there, Max.
Yeah, I think that it's individuality which is a key characteristic of European nations, and I think it's probably expressed more keenly amongst the British than other nations, just purely because we've been on the outside of Europe, so therefore we've been able to encourage individuality, and that individuality doesn't only sort of apply to people's characters in terms of the way that they conduct themselves in life. It's also individuality in terms of thought, and it's individuality in terms of thought that causes people to think outside the box, causes people to invent and innovate. And that's why we've been so good at those things in the past. And it's a shame, really, that one of the features of empires is that that there is this temptation to force conformity upon people. And so what we can see with empires that have tried to oppose us in the past, and that we've had wars with in the past, those empires have actually failed largely as a result of the enforced conformity. Because if you want to enforce conformity so that you can enforce your rule over a large number of people, then the requirement is that you chop down the tall poppies, or whatever the phrase is, and you kill off the people who are capable of independent thought and who are capable of thinking individually and innovatively, so that they conform with the orders that are being issued by the central power of that empire. And so this is the reason why the Soviets had such great difficulty in fighting the Germans during the Second World War, and it took a point to be reached where the Soviet army was something like nine times the size of the German army on the Eastern Front before the Soviets were able to push the German army back. And that's just purely because during the communist revolutions, people who were regarded as intellectuals, free thinkers, people who were individualists, were carted off to the gulags and exterminated. And that only left people who were prepared to follow orders, but who found it difficult to actually think and innovate for themselves. And, this principle that freedom of thought, freedom of action, and individuality are sort of key elements to a thriving nation. And that's something that we should always bear in mind.
Yeah, I was just going to say there, the extension of that, like this empire mentality of getting everybody to conform, at the far end of that, you've got these purges of the intellectuals that happened under communism. And also in Maoist China and in Cambodia, where they were even executing people just because they wore glasses, because they looked like they were intelligent. They got rid of the entire intelligentsia. And then you've got nobody that can come up with this innovation. I mean, what we should be doing, as we talked about last week, is teaching people about their identity, teaching people about their national identity, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, the things that they are likely to be good at, and these great heroes of our past that and whose blood flows within our veins, that we can emulate today, and we can reach deep within ourselves into that national spirit and tap into that, and we can succeed today, and people can still do great things today. We just need to know that and learn about it to realize who we really are and what we are really capable of. And thank you very much for that, Max. That was really interesting learning about the Battle of Trafalgar there. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Air in Britannia for you, and we will also probably be looking into Baron Baden-Powell. So you got that to look forward to. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
An alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArea.com.